America's number one show on pop culture and politics. This is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth. A particularly great day for me because I'm broadcasting today from the Ronald Reagan Library and having the opportunity to speak to my friend Peter Robinson, who was part of that historic administration. And Peter asked a very profound question and raised a very profound question in a speech that he gave here just 3 days ago at the Reagan Library, observing the 30th anniversary of this institution. Peter Robinson is a Murdoch Distinguished Policy Fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford, which turned down the opportunity for hosting the Reagan Library, this being more than 30 years ago. But he writes about business and politics. He edits Hoover's Quarterly Journal, the Hoover Digest, and hosts Hoover's video series program, Uncommon Knowledge. And Robinson is also the author of three books, all of which are outstanding, funny, insightful, and important. He wrote How Ronald Reagan Changed My Life in 2003. It's My Party, A Republican's Messy Love Affair with the GOP. And the best-selling business book, Snapshots from Hell, The Making of an MBA. Peter, it's great to speak to you, and congratulations on a wonderful speech that you gave right here just a couple of days ago.
Michael, it's a pleasure to talk to you, as always. I just wish somehow or other we'd been slightly more in sync and been there at the same time, but it's a pleasure.
Well, thank you so much. I played earlier today, some of the NBC News broadcast from November 9th, 32 years ago,
right,
when they had just announced that they were opening the border between East and West Germany. And you could hear the amazement in the voices of the broadcasters who were looking at this fateful change in the world. Can you think of any other change in our lifetimes that has meant more than the winning of the Cold War?
I can think of terrible events. I'm just old enough to remember John Kennedy's assassination. Of course, we all remember 9/11. What's so remarkable about, and we can remember, you and I can remember when Neil Armstrong first walked on the moon. What's so remarkable about the fall of the Berlin Wall is that it's a kind of triumphant event here on Earth that nevertheless took us completely by surprise. Where were you? May I ask you, Michael, may I do a little interviewing of you? Where were you? What were you thinking? How did you receive the news 32 years ago today?
We were still living in Los Angeles.
Right.
And I actually got the news when I got home. And I believe it was my wife who told me. Of course, you could see that it was coming because there were
right. These
rallies in Poland and in Germany and
yes. In
Russia and the breaking apart of the... But it happened so quickly.
Yes.
And I remember being fascinated and amazed by it, but not actually believing it. It just
Same
seemed
here.
Like one.
Yes, it seemed unreal, didn't it?
Yeah, I mean, how could this happen? We'd all grown up with this idea that there were these Soviet missiles that were pointed at our heads. Did you have any drills at school?
Yes. Oh no, I can remember. Sure, when I was a little kid in upstate New York, I remember being frightened, but not understanding why. The teachers, I don't know if you have this memory as well, we're roughly the same age, you must have similar memories, but the teachers would put us through drills, and when we heard a siren, and the siren went off, everybody was supposed to climb under his desk, and the teachers were very tense. They did not like whatever it was that was going on, whatever this represented, they didn't like it. And I remember as a child being mystified and slightly frightened because the teachers were frightened. Something was going on that worried them. And of course, what worried them was, in those days, people were still building bomb shelters in their backyards. the prospect of a nuclear exchange seemed extremely real. I was in elementary school just after the Cuban Missile Crisis. I think that if I have the timing right, that's when I started kindergarten. That had shaken the country. People really believed this might happen, a kind of nuclear exchange might happen.
Yeah, I know my parents did before that. I remember being in second grade, and this is in San Diego at Loma Portal Elementary School.
Right.
And my dad worked in the defense industry in San Diego, and so I was very conscious of bombs. And we had drills, and they had drills. It was like every month, and there would be a siren that would go off, and you'd have to hide under your desk.
Exactly. Exactly.
And I was a little, I mean, I was in second grade, but I was a really obnoxious kid, and which I know people can find easy to imagine. And I remember my teacher, who was Mrs. Abrams, and speaking to her and saying, can you explain to me something? Why are we, if they hit us with a nuclear bomb, the desk is not going to protect us.
Right.
We're going to all be burned up alive, right? Why do we go under the desk? And she basically shut me up and said, don't worry about people who know better than you.
Right.
I still don't really understand about why they would put the little kids under the desk. But this was real. This was part of what you're growing up with.
Yeah.
So the notion that this would be going away, that they were reaching nuclear disarmament, not entirely, but agreement.
Right.
I just read the Russians still have over 6,000 nuclear weapons.
Yes, I think that number sounds right to me. It's still an extremely dangerous country, of course. But what... Here's another question for you, Michael, if I'm allowed to just turn this into a conversation.
Please.
When I was at the Reagan, what I was so struck by as I thought through what I wanted to say, I was there Sunday, which marked the 30th anniversary of the original dedication of the library. And Ronald Reagan was there 30 years ago, and high-ranking cabinet officials were there. And 30 years later, the folks who run the Reagan Library are friends of mine, and they said, really, we need you to come because you're one of the last people who's up and walking around who actually remembers working with Ronald Reagan. So I get this feeling that something that remains terribly vivid to me, Ronald Reagan himself working in the White House, the end of the Cold War, 32 years ago when the wall fell, all of this to me is as vivid, to do a little old man talk, as if it happened yesterday. I don't know how to convey to my own children, to the students here at the Stanford campus, where, as you know, I work. All of them were born after the Cold War. They have no memory. The events that are important for them to understand are now passing from living memory. They're becoming purely historic. And I feel so frustrated because I'm just not, I don't know how to convey to the rising generation, you need to know this. You need to understand. In particular, given that the country we're badly divided, we face a rising China and so forth, you need to understand that in very recent history, you don't have to go back to the Cold War. You can go back just to the 1980s for a moment when this country underwent a national self-renewal, when our morale rose, when we stood up to a foreign power and we won a major conflict. You need to understand this. The conflict was real and we won. And I don't know how to convey all that, Michael. I just don't know how to do it.
Well, you're doing it now, and I want to continue on how we won. How Americans ended up being so stunned by actual victory in a conflict where many felt we could only lose. We'll be right back with Peter Robinson.
I was just thinking the other day that in our first administration, we made history, and in the second, we can change history forever.
Introducing the all
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
The optimism of Ronald Reagan, the belief that the Cold War could be won, that the evil empire could be broken and changed, that the world could change so phenomenally, it was a belief that most Americans didn't share. And you certainly must have had that sense when you were working in the White House, Peter Robinson. I'm speaking to Peter Robinson of the Hoover Institution at Stanford, who was one of President Reagan's principal speechwriters during the last years of President Reagan's term. Peter, when you were working in the White House, even in that second term, it did still seem inconceivable that the Soviet Union would break apart, that Ukraine and Latvia and would be independent nations, Latvia, Estonia, Lithuania. I mean, all around the world, the idea that they had the Velvet Revolution in the Czech Republic, and Czechoslovakia doesn't even exist anymore because Slovakia has its own independent existence. And none of this seemed even vaguely plausible. Science fiction, right?
That's exactly right. That's we were talking a moment ago about how hard it is to convey to the rising generation what was at stake in the Cold War, but also what was in people's minds, the range of options that seemed possible for us, let alone what people felt in Eastern Europe who had been occupied by the Soviets since the end of the Second World War, but for us in the West. But what it was in the 80s, it was after Ronald Reagan had been elected that Jean-François Revel, the French intellectual, published a book that was widely received, widely read in this country, and it was called How Democracies Perish. It was a very pessimistic little book. So even after Ronald Reagan takes office, there's a kind of grimness among one segment of the American public, and including, let us be honest about this, including some of our fellow conservatives, Michael, in those days, and the kind of default assumption about the Cold War was still that of Henry Kissinger and Richard Nixon and Jimmy Carter. The Soviet Union is a strong power. There's no immediate weakness. We have to manage the conflict between the United States and the Soviet Union because the Soviet Union is here to stay. And what was so distinctive about Ronald Reagan, so audacious, if I may, there were two qualities about Reagan that I believe were, well, apart from his courage as a person, his determination and willingness to say what he thought he was true, to speak his mind, but one was his moral clarity. By the time you get into detente, the President of the United States, Richard Nixon, greets Brezhnev and kisses him on both cheeks and drives him around on a golf cart as if he's a pal from New Jersey, an ordinary politician, that he falls within the range of what is normal and acceptable. And Ronald Reagan, as you well know, in one of his more controversial speeches, but in 1983, he says, beware, we must learn the lessons of history and beware the aggressive impulses of an evil empire. You could not push Ronald Reagan off that point. For all our faults, they were evil, and this country was fundamentally good. And then the second was the sheer audacity of his imagination, let's put it that way, of his moral imagination. There's a famous moment, 1977. This is after he's run for president and lost in 1976, and before he has decided that he'll run again in 1980. And Dick Allen, who is still with us, Richard Allen, who went on to become President Reagan's first national security advisor, gives President, or then former Governor Reagan, a briefing on world affairs at the governor's home in Pacific Palisades, California, just up the coast from where you grew up in San Diego. And then Dick Allen, I have this from Dick Allen himself. This is not a third or fourth hand account. This is from Dick Allen himself. The president, or the then former governor, listened, and then he said, by the way, would you like to hear my view of the Cold War? And Dick Allen said, well, of course, Governor, I want to hear your view. And Ronald Reagan said, well, some people think I'm simplistic, but there's a difference between being simple and being simplistic. My view of the Cold War is we win and they lose. It was breathtaking. Breathtaking. You couldn't find any other senior politician or political figure anywhere in the country who would state it just as simply as that. Not only are they evil and this country is good, they're collapsing. We'll win this. We will win this. It was, I mean, this is why it was so invigorating, thrilling, really, to be working for that man. You couldn't push him off the point, off the moral aspect of the conflict, and you couldn't push him off his fundamental confidence that we were going to win.
You know, I was thinking Mort Saul, who was in the era of Reagan, a very popular comedian, political comedian. He just died at the age of 92 or 93.
Oh, did he really?
Yeah,
sad.
He just passed away. Mort Saul had a line that always got a sort of bitter laugh. He said, you know, where I live, and he was living in New York at the time, the educated people, the optimists are teaching their children Russian. The pessimists are teaching their children Chinese.
Yes.
And the defeatism
in
the West was remarkably intense. We have some of the same thing now. I was wondering if you would care to speculate, knowing President Reagan and his thinking and his character's makeup, how would he respond to the idea of, well, for instance, to remake Thanksgiving, and some of the things I'm going to be talking about tonight, that Thanksgiving should be a national day of mourning.
It sounds
ludicrous, but there is a real attempt to do that, endorsed by leading and prominent Democrats. And what would his message be for what's called wokeness today?
Well, we know he'd be opposed to wokeness because wokeness says things that just aren't true. It says there's no difference between men and women. That's not true. It says the United States is a wicked place, corrupt from its very inception, racist from before it even became an independent nation. And these things just aren't true. Ronald Reagan would understood and would have said cheerfully, because he was so confident that he would have been right about this, he would have said, our faults we share with other nations throughout history. Our virtues make this country exceptional.
And speaking of exceptional, Peter, can you stay with us for one more segment?
Michael, are you kidding? With you, I'll stay with you as long as you want.
Thank you. Look forward. We'll be right back with Peter Robinson on what we do about raising America's spirits now. Coming up.
Go out there and win one for the Gipper.
Here 7 years ago, many of us for the first time, it was with the hope of beginning something new for America. We meet here tonight in this historic chamber to continue that work. If anyone expects just a proud recitation of the accomplishments of my administration, I say let's leave that to history. We're not finished yet.
President Reagan, that sounds like it must have been a State of the Union address. That's what he was talking about. We have a State of the Union address coming up in a couple of months. And today, when you look at the recollections of the Reagan administration, of course, my guest Peter Robinson has them from the inside. Looking back on the history that you've lived and you've experienced, Peter, clearly something went wrong. Actually, a lot of things went wrong. We were talking here today about a problem that I know you experienced. You're at the Hoover Institution. You live in the Bay Area, and I know that you don't have a homeless problem on the Stanford campus, thank God. Yeah. But you certainly do in the Bay Area. It seems to me this is such a gigantic problem nationwide that politicians don't even address right now.
Right.
You're a very profound and important political thinker. And I think there's a general sense that the stuff that really bothers Americans most, our politicians don't really touch anymore. Certainly not in the way that Reagan dealt with the economic issues, the foreign policy issues that we've been talking about. What do you think is most important to try to get our leaders more in touch with changes that need to be made to bring America back to an optimistic vision for the country?
Well, we need to throw them out, Michael. The current crop needs to be sent into a long delayed and richly deserved retirement, for goodness sake. That's what we need to do. I don't know. I know you well enough. We haven't spoken about this, but I know you well enough that as the election results came in from Virginia last Tuesday, a week ago Tuesday, you were thrilled.
Absolutely.
And I'm totally thrilled. You said to yourself the same thing that I said to myself and that we undoubtedly said to ourselves on election day in 1980 and again in 1984, oh, I love democracy. I just love democracy. The journalism of the day is corrupt. The establishment, the Democratic Party establishment, Terry McAuliffe, oh my goodness. I mean, this is a bagman for the Clinton operation. And we've already known what Bill Clinton got up to in his off moments. Now these Durham indictments are producing, making it undeniable that the whole Russian collusion hoax was a dirty trick by the Clinton campaign. It made anything that Richard Nixon ever dreamt of doing look like the merest trifle. And Terry McAuliffe is right in the middle of this Clinton organization. And the voters of Virginia said, no, something just, don't call us racist. Don't tell us we don't have the right to educate our children. Don't try to assault Glenn Youngkin. Glenn Youngkin is a wealthy man, but it's, you know how he made his money. It was straightforward. He was a bank. Don't do that. As a matter of fact, you know what? I'm voting against you. You guys, take a walk. The most thrilling comment of the evening in my, and of course, I was flipping back and forth, as I'm sure you were, I grit my teeth and go over to MSNBC, and I grit my teeth and I click over to CNN to see how they're handling it all. And of course, it's within moments. They must have seen exit polling earlier in the day because they knew it was going to go against them. And within moments, they're talking about the racism of the Republican Party and how voters were endorsing white supremacy. And then the new lieutenant governor-elect, Winsome Sears, appears on Fox News, and she says the Democratic Party has taken African Americans for granted for decade after decade after decade. And then she uttered this phrase. I don't know whether she knew she was uttering one of the most powerful lines anyone had ever spoken in American politics. My advice to the Democrats is go find new victims. Oh, my goodness. It's thrilling. I mean, I had the same thrill that I used to feel when I was a little kid watching the Marines have landed. And it's democracy. It's democracy. It's a thrilling thing. So I'm optimistic. I had no idea it was going to be this. The news was going to be so good from Virginia. 2 weeks ago, my view used to be I'm sort of long-term optimistic. I remember the 70s, as you do. There was a whole decade that went wrong. And it took a while for it to work its way out and for Ronald Reagan to be elected president and for the renewal to take place. But it looks to me as though the renewal is going to happen pretty quickly. Just think. Republicans recapture the House at least and maybe the Senate next year. And then think of the bench. Now, I myself, I have to say, some listeners won't be happy about this. I hope that Donald Trump chooses not to run again.
Amen.
And here's why. The meaning of Glenn Youngkin's victory in Virginia is that the next generation has broken through. And our next generation is spectacular. Glenn Youngkin, Ron DeSantis in Florida, Tom Cotton, Ben Sasse, Ted Cruz, Nikki Haley, Tim Scott of South Carolina.
We were talking earlier today about Mike Pompeo, who is lost a bunch of weight. And
it was a
terrific congressman, aside from Secretary of State.
Terrific congressman, went over and ran the CIA. This guy is a tough guy. He knows how Washington works. And he ran the CIA. The CIA is, as we know, our intelligence agencies have at least in some veins within the intelligence agencies have become corrupted. That's now clear from the Russian. But Pompeo goes across to Virginia and runs the CIA, then runs the State Department. This next generation on our side is really impressive. They're smart. They're well versed. They know how to handle themselves, and they're ready to go.
By the way, I asked Newt Gingrich. I had Newt Gingrich on last week.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked him who he thought the Democratic nominee would be in 2024, because it won't be Joe Biden.
Right.
And it certainly won't be Kamala Harris.
Right.
I mean, assuming someone runs against her. But he said without hesitation, Gavin Newsom.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, I'd like to see that. I would like to see that. Wouldn't you?
Well,
there's not much to Gavin Newsom.
No, but I think the reason that Newt said that, and the reason I think that is, okay, what are the alternatives? I mean,
that's right.
Where else are you going to go? He's governor of California. He has got all kinds of publicity for defeating the recall, and he's up for reelection this coming year.
Right.
And but who knows? I mean, the point is, I worry, Peter, and between you and me, that it's deeper than partisan politics, and it may take more than one election. And I brought up the homeless thing because I don't see any of these wonderful Republicans, and I admire most of the people that you mentioned, but we're not addressing that. We're not addressing some of the deeper and ongoing problems with education. I think that was one of the most encouraging thing I found about Glenn Youngkin's victory, is taking a look at education and shaking it up and moving in the right direction. Peter Robinson of the Hoover Institution, let's close out the hour with Peter coming up on the Medved Show.
Let history say of us, these were golden years when the American Revolution was reborn, when freedom gained new life and America reached for her best.
Michael Medved Show, pleasure always to speak with my friend Peter Robinson, who is the fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford, where he writes about business and politics. By the way, the Stanford Quarterly, the Hoover Institution Digest that comes out every quarter, is indispensable. And I read thoroughly every time that it comes out. It's a handsome and beautifully illustrated and a wonderful publication. And Peter, just a quick question here. And there's a piece in the Boston Globe just posted. I don't know if you've seen it. It says,
just put literally while we've been talking, I haven't looked at the news. No.
Yes, it's, can Biden pull a Ronald Reagan in 2022?
No.
He has the economic numbers to tell a persuasive story. So what do you think?
No, of course not. Of course not. Listen, Joe Biden could have pulled, let's say Joe Biden could have pulled a John Kennedy If Joe Biden were younger and had any foresight, vision, courage, he could have said, look, I'm a guy from Scranton. My people, I grew up with Irish people and Italians in Scranton. My grandparents worked the coal mines. Our kind of Democrat was Franklin Roosevelt. We're here to help the little guy, the working man. Woke stuff? No, thank you. That's not my Democratic Party. He could have reclaimed the center for the Democratic Party, and in that case, he would have been very, very formidable. Instead, he went straight to the left. He wasn't elected to do it. Americans can hardly believe he's enacting these huge... Anyway, you get the picture. He had an opportunity, I believe, a real political opportunity, but he had no vision, no... Honestly, I suppose no energy either. He's just... He's not... He doesn't... Let's put it this way. There are younger 78-year-olds in America than Joe Biden.
That is entirely correct. And again, he's just, I think he's coming up to his 79th birthday.
Yes.
Because his birthday is in November. Okay, quick question here, because this is something else that people don't know about Reagan. Is Reagan's first big national stage accomplishment that a lot of people had thought to be unbelievable, inconceivable, was uniting the Republican Party. Mm. Because when he was running for the nomination in 1980, he had lost the nomination to Gerald Ford in 1976. He had some formidable opposition, including his future vice president, George Herbert Walker Bush.
Yes.
But this is the challenge right now. You're talking about our great bench. What do we do now to follow Reagan's example and uniting the party so it can work effectively and not be splintered by all kinds of bitter primary contests, which are coming up in state after state after state for 2022?
Mm. Well, Glenn Youngkin showed the way. Glenn Youngkin demonstrated respect for Donald Trump, but at the same time made clear that he didn't particularly wish to have the former president campaigning for him in Virginia. He wanted to be his own man. He respected and talked about Donald Trump's achievements, tax cuts, an economy that produced real increases in wages for ordinary working people for the first time in decades, recognizing that China was our adversary, no longer, or if it ever was, our friend. Rebuilding our national defenses. All of these were genuine accomplishments, and Glenn Youngkin said as much. Now, what he doesn't want is the kind of bitter divisiveness that Donald Trump seems to engender. By the way, let's stipulate that Donald Trump, whatever his faults, is far more sinned against than sinning. That his presidency was as bitter a time in this nation's history as it was is at least as much the fault of the Democrats and the press who ginned up this absurd Russian collusion story and absorbed national attention for over 2 years with it. So I'm not trying to denigrate Donald Trump personally, and neither did Glenn Youngkin. But Glenn Youngkin's campaign said, in effect, we respect the accomplishments, we respect him, we certainly respect the people who voted for Donald Trump. There was no condescension in anything that Glenn Youngkin said or did or in his bearing. But at the same time, he was able to talk about the future. He wasn't getting hung up on the injustices done to Donald Trump. He wasn't going to permit himself to get drawn into to discussions about this or that election irregularity in the last presidential election. He had his own agenda. That's the way forward, I think. I'm hoping that the former president says, I'm not going to seek the nomination, but I will campaign for the party.
What I'm worried about, Peter, and it's honestly, I don't think it's too early to worry about it, because it's happening right now, is in about 12, 14 states so far, there are major primary contests mm-hmm. involving Republican office holders. I mean, Greg Abbott has a challenge for his renomination in Texas from Alan West. We have in Alaska, Senator Murkowski, who is a crucial vote. Every Senate vote is crucial.
Yes, it is.
Has a very formidable Republican challenger and a fairly well-funded, well-thought-of Democratic challenger. Mm-hmm. The idea of the Republican Party in 2022 spending all of its energy and effort in knocking out other Republicans scares me. That's basically what I'm talking about. You get the last word on this.
Oh, well, you know, I don't know. Michael, I share so many of your worries and have for so, you and I have known each other for years and years now, that far be it from me to say, Michael, relax just a little. But that's my impulse. I mean, look at Virginia, look at New Jersey. Nobody was paying, including me, I'm willing to
admit,
was paying any attention to New Jersey. We are placing a long-term bet that self-government works, Michael. And even the voters of Alaska are going to be able to sort it out and get a reasonable answer. And Lord knows that the voters of Texas are going to will recognize Greg Abbott for his remarkable accomplishments. And Greg Abbott, it'll be okay. I truly believe it'll be okay.
I certainly hope so. I remember, as you remember, I did an interview with you for your book in 2000.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's My Party, a Republican's Messy Love Affair with the GOP. It really is always that way, and actually going back to 1856 and 1860, as you know and have written about, it's been that way. It is wonderful to be speaking to you and to celebrate this moment. It's a 30th anniversary of this great Reagan Library Institution, and also to celebrate what Gerard Baker was writing about today. I was talking about it on the air today. He said, voters decide to make America sane again. And let's hear it for sanity, which also is probably the best way to deal with the homeless issue, too, which we were talking about. Peter, I want to let people know that coming up tomorrow, we will be joined by a number of distinguished guests, including the author of a stinging indictment of the news media from a deputy editor at Newsweek, where I'm privileged to write regularly. Her name is Batya Unger Sargon. She has a new book called Bad News. We'll be talking to Arthur Herman, a defense expert, about what you do about countering the Chinese expansion of military power, attempts to expand into diplomatic power and more. And also talking to someone who's written a fairly remarkable book about basically life on the streets and what is really involved in terms of insanity and drug abuse and other problems that contribute to that, particularly in the American heartland. And then we'll also talk a little bit about what I'm speaking about tonight at the Reagan Library, which has to do with an attempt, really, by people who seem bent on destroying American optimism and suggesting that Thanksgiving should not be a time for gratitude, it should be a time for guilt. Do we really want a national day of mourning 2 weeks from now when we're celebrating our great national feast? There's also a piece in the New York Times that says that because of disagreements over the pandemic, it may not be safe to have Thanksgiving meals together with people with whom you disagree. I hope that's not the case. There can be thankfulness and gratitude for this greatest nation on God's green earth.